Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
No, madam.
And we're going to talk about Sinners. We're going to talk about the Fantastic Four trailer. We're going to talk about some Star Wars news. And Adam has something that he watched that I don't know about. So I'm excited.
Well, we kind of talked about it, but I basically... So, yeah. Do we want to just get into that right now? Just,
yeah.
Because we're... If you feel like we're a little less lackadaisical than we usually are, we're a little bit on a time frame because we are recording this on Easter Sunday. So, you know, we're going to be a little bit economical here. So I just finished the HBO Max series this week. Like, we started it on Saturday, Sunday of last week. And I just finished it last night, The Pit. The Noah Wiley, John Wells produced TV series, which is basically the concept is it's set in an ER. You know, Noah Wiley is known for that, but it's set in an ER in Pittsburgh over a 15-hour. It's supposed to be a 10-hour shift, but it goes 15 hours because something that happens late in the shift. But it basically is like a real time. It's like hour to hour of a day in the life of this Pittsburgh ER. Man, Logan, I'm going to tell you, it is probably some of the best TV I've seen in a very, very, very long time. It actually, we're going to be talking about something, and it kind of ruined it because this is so good. Like, it was like, oh, okay, well, yeah, that happened. I can't wait for season two. This fucking show is amazing. I didn't even think about it. Stephanie's a nurse. This might be very triggering for her. It's set in an ER, and everything that it's like what I've heard is like a typical day until the last like 4 hours. But man, like this is like a crazy, crazy show that it deals with death. It deals with treatment of medical staff. It deals with like PTSD from being like there's a storyline about like COVID and a particular character's having to deal with death during COVID era and how he still shook from it. Like, you know, drug abuse, like it's all there, but I'm going to tell you, Logan, it's like I said, it's one of the best produced shows, one of the best acted shows and best written shows that I've seen in a very, very long time. Like it just smacks you in the face, but it's so filled and welled up with humanity. It's so well cast. Like this show gives you the spectrum of every single, it's not just a bunch of white people in the nurse or like in an ER, like just saving a bunch of like people. It's like it's staffed and it's cast with just the spectrum of anybody and everybody that actually works in an ER. I mean, I know just because I've had friends that worked in ERs, nurses. And like, this is the thing. And I think that this is the thing that will actually hook Stephanie is that they make it very clear that the nurses run the ER. Like they, like, yeah, the doctor saves lives and stuff. But I mean, even the doctors in the show, like very much are deferential to the nurses. And that's something I know just by knowing a couple of nurses.
I've heard nothing but good things about this show. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's been on my radar because it keeps popping up on any podcast I listen to. They talk about TV or anything. It's like, are y'all watching The Pit? Oh my God.
Yeah.
This shouldn't be a Max show. This should be like HBO prestige TV show.
It is. Yeah, it is. like John Wells is on fire. It was almost like, I can only imagine that, I can't remember the creator's name, but between the three of them, they were like, you know, Eo was good, but we really couldn't get the sense of how people deal with ER stuff on a day-to-day basis and how pressure cooker is for a day in the life of like anybody in him. Like, this is the kind of show that you're going to hear the Emmy nominations come out.
Oh, yeah. I've heard like multiple people say, yeah, Noah Wiley's going to get the Emmy. Like, there's no doubt.
Yeah. The thing that surprised me, and I think that you're a fan of this guy because we both looked outside of Providence, Sean Ousty, or Ousty? I cannot remember his name. The lead from Outside Providence. He's actually in this show. He plays like a supporting role. I won't ruin it, but God damn, he's so good in this show. Like he's actually given, like, it was like, I loved him in Outside of Providence, and then he kind of just went nowhere, right? He was like he was almost like, and it's so shitty for me to say, but he's like a poor man's Cole Hauser, right? Like, they both looked like he was in The Faculty, but he never did anything. And like, he gets like this role as a guy who's like an ex-military doctor. And man, like, he comes in, he starts in the show, and then he comes in at a certain point, and it's just like my wife said, he's like, who the fuck is this guy? And I was like, do you remember The Faculty? And she's like, shit, damn, he's just aged up. He's just like, he's like your age. And I'm like, yeah, like, you know, he's about my age. Like, everybody's great at this. But like, Noel Wiley, oh man, like, he's on fire. Like,
yeah. I think this and Matlock are probably the two shows that I don't watch that I hear the most about.
Yes, I keep on hearing Matlock is definitely on deck for me. I mean, you know me, Matt. Like, I'm gonna watch it, right? It's like the only thing that kind of makes with Matlock, you know, and I know this sounds shitty of me, but it's like, CBS, all you had to do was go to fucking Ruffalo and say, Columbo, we're ready, and you did. You went to fucking, I mean, I love Kathy Bates and all,
yeah,
like, you know, service Kathy Bates, I love, but come on, he's at the perfect age right now. Like, I actually literally checked recently, and he's like literally plus or minus 1 year away from being the same age as
Isn't that wild how, like,
yeah,
50 or 60 something now versus like 50 or 60 something in the like 80s.
Yeah, 70s and 80s.
Like, yeah.
Like, that just tells me that not only, like, it's also drinking and smoking, like, affect you, right? Like, really affect you. Because we're smoking and drinking, it's like, your body, like, smoking and drinking, he was like, well, and plus, all the things. But yeah, the pit, like, I mean, I know because people have, like, you know, we knew because my wife is a social worker, right? Like, that's what her training is in. And she has a group of social worker friends. And one of her really good friends, Arne, recommended it because she was like, there's a social worker character in there, and the way that they treat her and the way that they portray her is exactly 100% what social workers are. And so it went to the top of our list. And then when we found out that, like, a couple of our nursing friends were like, this is exactly what ER nurses deal with on a day-to-day basis and the way that they portray them, we were just like, okay, like, you know, we're in the medical community, but man, it's tough. It's like, it's one of those watches, it's like, where you're compelled to watch it again more and more because of the stories, that are happening, but it deals with some pretty hardcore subjects. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully I'll get to it before season two. It being not a, well, even just being a cable / streaming show, I imagine it's going to be like late 2026 at best before we get season two, but maybe early 2027. So,
yeah, they're already working, like, supposedly Wells is already working on it, because HBO, as soon as they started seeing the numbers, were like, yeah, we really need to do this.
Here's a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
If this show weren't good, do you think that the lawsuits would be happening?
No, I absolutely do not.
Yeah, they just are like, oh, yeah. It's because it's good and people are talking about it and it is generating, you know, some buzz for Max. So if anybody doesn't know, the estate of Michael Crichton is trying to sue Warner Brothers.
Brothers over this.
Yeah, saying that they are... And I get it, like, they, for the longest time, they were trying to do this sequel series for ER, like a legacy kind of show, and they couldn't ever make it work, and they just retooled it into this, eventually, and I do understand that sucks, but... You know, it would be like Bill Lawrence and company suing NBC and what's that guy's name? The St. Denis Medical.
I can't think of the guy's name.
But he came from like the office of the Michael Schur, you know, Schur, kind of. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I know who you're talking about. I can't think
of Justin something. Anyway, okay, because it's a half hour medical comedy, like, no.
Like, exactly. It's really not, like, the thing that it does is that it's set in an ER. Like, ER does stuff very differently. I loved ER. Like, as a kid, I watched it. And ER, it's about, my world and what it's telling, that the macro of ER is. Like, you know, it's like Chicago Hope. Why are they doing Chicago Hope at the time? Because they're the same drama. They're about the ins and outs of the day-to-day life. It's not just specifically dealing with, like, what it's like in the ER. That's not. But, right? So, you're right. It's like, come on, guys. Really? Michael Crichton's face makes so much money off of everything that he does.
Yeah.
Why are you going to, like, you just made a ton of money off of Twisters. What do you do? Like, it's literally the studio that he has, like, all basically all of his films have been made at.
Yeah.
I don't get it. It's well enough to,
like, it feels like, and it's hard, like, we come down so hard on Warner's and, like, the people in charge, specifically Zaslav. So much so that, like, for a while, this could have just been Logan and Adam complain about David Zaslav. I mean, we were still doing it a few months ago when we were talking about Looney Tunes, not even a month ago. So it's weird to just be like, kind of on their side about this. Like, I get it. Like, the show y'all were trying to do, you just couldn't get it worked out because it didn't. The show didn't work, or the negotiations, like whatever piece of whatever, just didn't work out. And so now they just like, okay, we're going to move forward with a different medical thing. And, you know, I didn't watch a lot of ER, but I did watch some of it. And I haven't seen any of The Pit except for, like, the trailers. And even I can look at it and be like, yeah, these aren't remotely the same, except for the fact that Noah Wiley is in the show. Like, that's it, man. You know, it's like if you got the entire OG cast, okay, then maybe it's just like, look, y'all got the entire original cast of ER and then just called it something else. But yet, one guy, who wasn't the breakout star of that show.
No, and here's the thing. Okay, so I'm gonna say this: if like ER is like a John Wayne World War II movie, and The Pit is Steven Spielberg Saving Private Ryan. Like, that's the difference. Like, it's like John Wayne's Sands of Iwo Jima is ER, right? It's glossy, it's melodramatic, it's very well made, but it's not.
And it's really weird that, like, it's the estate of Michael Crichton. Like, this isn't somebody. Like, there's a lot of lawsuits that happen about stuff like this that don't even get, like, big, even remotely big press about them. But I think one, like, notable one is, like, the Matrix stuff. And how you can kind of, like, look into that and be like, maybe there's a point, but, like, also it's a little different. But that was somebody who, like, was not well known. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, there isn't an estate of this author who says that, hey, like, these were my ideas and they took them. This is the estate of Michael Crichton, who is probably getting a hefty paycheck off of a movie that is coming out this year.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't, like, they haven't stopped making the Jurassic movies, man. I gotta imagine that you get a chunk of change from that. And you're going after Warner Brothers because they developed a medical show when the one y'all were working on. It just didn't pan out. Like, it feels just icky. I don't like it. I don't like that I have to be like, Warner Brothers has a point.
Seriously, dude.
Because, like, you want to be on the, like, the OG creator side of things, because a lot of times creators do get the real, like, short end of the stick. But, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the estate of Michael Crichton doesn't get much of dick from all of this stuff. But, I really don't think so.
He comes from, so, like, that show was created during the time where creators like Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David, like, when it went into syndication, Michael Crichton made something like $75 to $80 million, and that was back in like 2000s money.
Yeah.
So basically triple it. Like, he made probably about $250,000. He didn't make Jerry and Larry money, but he still made enough. And like, the thing is that he got paid every single time TNT decided to show one an episode.
And for a while, like, the way USA kind of became like the Law and Order network. Like, TNT was just like, oh, Jesus. All they do is show ER for, like, 14 hours a day. I do want to check it out. the lawsuit is a really interesting thing. And I'm just like, I don't care how much you press it. I don't think there's, even in the state of this country, I don't think there's a judge in this country that's like, yeah, like, you should pay them money. Man, these are two different shows. Very different shows.
Exactly. So, and like I said, like it's one of those things where I'm like, yeah, no, absolutely not. And I hope it gets dismissed right away.
So let's talk about some Star Wars stuff.
Yes.
So a Celebration is happening, is actually wrapping up right now. We got not a ton of announcements, but we got some pretty solid ones. Star Wars Starfighter will be the next live action Star Wars film. After Mandalorian and Grogu. I don't count. Like that seems like a Disney Plus thing that is gonna just be dumped in theaters. Because you know they're like shooting it the way they shoot the Mandalorian.
Okay, so like I did want to ask just really quick, did you see the trailer? The teaser thing? No. They actually dropped, it was hard to find, but there was a teaser trailer drop. Did you see it?
No, I didn't.
Okay. It looks like, if it's real, and I went to multiple different places, and it took me a while to, the first time I found it, it was literally right when it posted, somebody did a live. And posted that live onto their Instagram and instantly got deleted, right? And then I had to go around at 4 o'clock in the morning and look for it, but there were a couple of different angles and it looks like it wasn't AI generated. They had a look at it, which was kind of like a teaser, which I want to watch, I almost can imagine that this could be dropped on us on the Thunderbolts. In theaters, but it doesn't.
You don't think it'll be on the Revenge of the Sith re-release next week?
It could be that too. It could drop on that too. But the thing that I saw, it looks like the complaint about the volume stuff may have been resolved because it looks very much like they did not film on the volume. Who knows? Maybe I'm wrong.
The volume could have gotten better too, but
that's true.
The thing about it, it looks fine for television, but we saw a movie mostly filmed on the volume and it did not look great.
It did not.
A lot of complaints about Quantumania, but the biggest one is, dude, you can tell.
We could tell instantly on the trailers, right? We could tell, oh man. Hopefully it's a good movie. And then we found out. This one, we'll probably be able to instantly tell if they drop a trailer. And also what it says if they drop a trailer a year before. Because that takes confidence, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like there are things that drop a year ahead. And it's that ballsy. That's confidence. Even 6 months. So I'm interested because, it definitely... from the look of it, they showed a scene of the Mando taking on.
See a picture of Pedro Pascal without the helmet, in the outfit.
Yes, I did see that too. It looks interesting. I'm genuinely curious if this is not AI generated. If this is what they're gonna if they're gonna maybe drop it, you said on Revenge of the Sith stuff. On Revenge of the Sith, the 20th, special screenings.
It's the 20th
anniversary. Right? Jesus Christ! Yeah, it's the 20th. Oh, so, Jesus, I feel old.
But yeah. Anyway. So the Star Wars Starfighter thing. Yeah. Ryan Gosling, Sean Levy. I'm cautiously optimistic.
Me too.
When it was announced, I was like, okay, this is going to be literally every other live action Star Wars film that we've had announced by somebody who who isn't Jon Favreau, because nothing's come to fruition. Absolutely nothing. No. So I was like, this will fall by the wayside too, but you got Ryan Gosling showing up at Star Wars Celebration to be like, hey man, we're making this movie.
We're a month out from making this movie, basically. Like, so that means sets are being built, script is done. Well, I also think that they got their hand forced on this. I don't think that he shows up unless the Mikey Madison news didn't get dropped. That's perfectly honest. Like, we recently just heard that Mikey Madison passed on Star Wars, which I don't know why you went to Mikey Madison. Like, she's a 25-year-old ingenue that just won an Oscar. It's like the equivalent of having Jennifer Lawrence. Like, you trying to get Jennifer Lawrence to do a, like, you know, like, it's like Jennifer Lawrence before, like, you know, it's like Jennifer Lawrence and she hadn't done an X-Men movie, and then you trying to get her to do an X-Men movie after she wins her first Oscar.
Yeah.
I mean, we literally saw what happened after she won her
post Oscar. Like, those performances in those movies were, I mean, they were a little kind of like lackadaisical to begin with, but like, you could really see she was like, I do not give a shit about this. I'm here under contract. I am checked the fuck out.
Yeah. Like, and that's the comparison. Cause like, I kept on seeing people like shocked that she passed it. And then other people like chuckling, hey, she passed on the Star Wars.
If it's not her thing, like, good.
Yeah.
Don't put people in the movie that are just going to be like, I don't want to be here, man. Like, put people in the movie that, you know, want to be it. Like, for all the complaints about the sequel trilogy, I get most of them. None of the new cast in those movies didn't want to be there. Like, even by the end. Like, John Boyega had not a great experience. And even in the end, he was just like, I'm here. I'm giving it all I got because it's fucking Star Wars, man. Like, exactly. I want to be in this.
The reason why he's pissed is not because, like, the reason why he was pissed is not because he was forced to do it. The reason why he was pissed was because JJ and company fucked him over.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what he was told he was supposed to be, what his storyline was supposed to be, as opposed to what it ended up being, are two very different things.
Yeah.
You know, but it's also very nice to see, like, Gosling's engaged. Like, that's the thing that makes me go, ah, okay.
That's like, when I was like, oh, this is definitely happening. Like, him showing up, him being, like, fully into, like, you can tell that he's...
Yeah.
Into this, he's excited for it, and that makes me excited. Even if it winds up being, like, you know, I specifically, but I think we greatly enjoyed Deadpool Wolverine. Clearly, a lot of people did. What was the other Ryan Reynolds movie he made? Well, he made a couple. Oh, I didn't see the Adam Project or whatever it's called.
Yeah, but, the Adam Project.
What was the video game one? Free Guy, right?
Free Guy.
Yeah. I think I watched some of it. I didn't watch the whole thing. It didn't really do much for me. And I'm kind of hit or miss on the Night at the Museum stuff. I mean, he's a decent filmmaker who made a one-of-a-kind blockbuster movie, and now he's going to get a shot at Star Wars. If the worst that happens is that he turns in something that's, Solo-esque, I guess, but I enjoyed Solo, then okay, it's a moderate, like, decent Star Wars movie. But it could also be really fucking good.
It really could. Like, the thing is that this is a guy who, like, at every turn... His movies are, at a bare minimum, like, good. Like, entertaining.
Yeah. Right?
Like, some of these Star Wars films are not even entertaining. Like, I will say The Rise of Skywalker, like, to me, like, when I watch it, like, I watched it probably about 8 months ago. And I'm like, yeah, I know the reason why I don't watch it anymore, because it's a checkbox of a plot.
Yeah.
Like you're not engaged.
It's a video game fetch quest, which is so frustrating.
Very much so is. And so it's like,
I mean, the first movie was Force Awakens was kind of like that too. When you go back to it, yeah. Like, yeah. You know,
it's, well, it's Star Wars 77 remade.
Yeah.
It's really what it is. Like, oh, we couldn't do anything better, so we're going to have a Death Star, but it's not going to be a Death Star. It's not going to be called Death Star. Like, it's going to be a planet. And I, man, like, I don't know. Like the sequel trilogy is really kind of whatever. I just want them to make it, like, it's like the thing that, like you said, the thing that that's like Solo, like the thing that makes Solo great is that it's just telling a story. Like, at the end of the day, I think what bothered me was it's all of this, like, the thing that still bothers me is all of the prequel-esque stuff, like the checking, the nod, nod, nudge, nudge stuff, like, huh? Look at this. We're doing this. We're doing, yep. when Han and Chewie met. We're doing, well, so you don't have people. What do you want to Solo? It's like, come on. Like, that shit is boring to me. But, like, everything else about the movie, I love, because it's just, it's the Ron Howard of it all. It's just, you're just telling a fucking movie. You're just telling a fucking story. You're just, yep. telling the story. Not doing anything else. Right? Like what makes Willow great? Is that after you get through all the myth building of the first 30 minutes, when you meet Mad Mardigan, it becomes a rollicking adventure. And mm-hmm. it just tells the story. If they just tell a story in the post Last Jedi or the last of the Rise of Skywalker, because that's when it's supposed to take place, man, that's all I care about. Just tell me an adventure story. Like, get back to Star Wars-ing, because this is not Star Wars-ing.
Yeah. So we got two other, like, moderately big pieces of news. One is that who is replacing Ray Stevenson as Baylan Skull in Ahsoka season 2. And it's one of our favorite Game of Thrones actors. I know you weren't.
Oh yeah.
But he was absolutely wonderful on that show. Like, just this perfect mix of, like, brutal and kind of sweet. And, you know, I think his and Arya's story, like, that whole thing is probably my favorite thing in Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
But Rory McCann is replacing Ray Stevenson as Baylan Skull. And I think, like, they look very different, but I also think it is a perfect bit of casting, because he is so intimidating, and that's what you need.
Oh, 100%. Like, I, no notes on this one. Like, we had heard rumors of it a while ago, that this was going to be the thing, but I personally, like, you know, once it's connected, I was like, okay, that this is no notes, because it's not a casting to likeness, it's a casting of, like, as the kids call it, aura.
Yeah.
And it works. Like, I feel like, and all, like, I'm just gonna say this, like, it almost feels like you want to go back and go, why didn't you cast Rory McCann at the beginning? Because there's a lightness to Stevenson's touch. Yeah. Like, Rory McCann, he's a bastard. Like, through and through. Like, there's a movie that he's in that I love, which is Jumanji 2. And he plays the main villain. And he's only in it, like maybe 15 minutes. But the sense of menace that you get from Rory McCann in those 15 minutes is palpable. Like, he doesn't feel like the way that Ray Stevenson is, like, I'm going to be a bastard, but I'm not going to be that much of a bastard.
Yeah, like, he's got, like, there's, like, a little bit of heart to him. Not that Rory McCann can't have that, but, like, he doesn't wear that on his face, I guess.
Yes.
You know, 100%. It's very, he's just immediately very intimidating, and, I'm happy that we're not going to get some weird messed up, like, CGI nonsense to try to, you to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
And I'm glad we're not just going to see the character like sunsetted because of what happened. I mean, it sucks, and it sucks that we don't get to see him like finish out that performance, because it is probably the best thing in that first season of Ahsoka. But, you know, we get to see where the character goes, because he's a very interesting character. And I'm happy to have McCann in the world of Star Wars. Like, that's that's fantastic. The other big thing was the drop of like, hey guys, Star Wars Animation not dying. We've got Darth Maul.
Yeah, we're starting to cook. Like, well, I mean, we already know Tales from Tales of the Outlaws, or Tales of the Underworld is happening. Then we get this thing with you know, the Maul storyline is going to continue, which is kind of like, we're still getting payments off of the wondrous, like, you know, beautiful series that is Clone Wars. Like, we're like, it's still paying dividends. Like, I'm amazed at how, like, I mean, it's one of, like, it's one of my favorite Star Wars things. I think that you, like, I think that one of the things that we bonded over was the fact that we felt so strongly about Clone Wars. Like, this was
I will forever hold it over Spencer's head. So, back in the Film Dispenser days,
yes,
before you came on to the site, before Justin came on, and I had just started working with him, and it's when Rafa was on there, and it was Spencer and Raphael, and we're podcasting about Star Wars, and the question came to like, what's my favorite Star Wars movie? And I was like, does it just have to be a movie? Like, it's Return of the Jedi if it's movie, but my favorite Star Wars is not a movie. And they were like, the TV show? I'm like, do y'all watch the TV show? Like, no, we're not watching that. Like, but you should be watching it.
Exactly.
And I think it was probably in its like second or third season at that point, maybe. And I mean, sure enough, here we sit 13 years later or whatever it was, maybe 12 years later, and Spencer has a son named Ezra, very much in part because Clone Wars gets us to Rebels, and Rebels gives us Ezra Bridger, and what those shows have come to mean to true blue Star Wars fans. You know, it's I mean, D. Bradley Baker is legend. You know, Matt Lanter is as much Anakin Skywalker for us as Hayden Christensen.
I mean, so much so that shows are now Ahsoka emulated the Clone Wars version of him, because I mean, we have an entire show. I mean, Jar Jar, like, without Jar Jar in the Clone Wars, Ahmaud Best doesn't get his flowers. Like, yeah, let's be honest. Like, he doesn't, like, a lot of, like, oh man, like, it is such a big, like, Clone Wars is such a big reason why Star Wars survived the way that it did. Like, it really does. Like, it gets to so many connective tissues, right?
And seeing it continue just in these offshoots, even if they're more or less kind of limited series things. We did have the Bad Batch for a few years, which was great.
Yeah.
I'm excited for what they can do with Darth Maul. I know there's a faction of people like, oh, here we go mining the story. Like, we already know where this ends. Like, I mean, we already know where a lot of stuff ends, but it's, you know, about Maul's journey, and there's still so much of it that we don't really know. And I mean, he's just a fascinating character. Like, just because it's set like post Clone Wars, like pre Rebels,
Rebels, yeah.
Like, it doesn't mean that there's not a lot of great stuff to explore there. It also doesn't mean we can't get into his, like, past, you know, like, how did he become the apprentice, you know, like, where does that, you know, what did that do? Well, we kind of see what it did to him, but yeah, I don't know. There's just so much there. And I don't know if you like read the breakdown, but, oh, shit, I just drew a blank on his name. Sam Witwer, has been like, first of all, if there's anybody who's in Star Wars, who's more passionate and knowledgeable about Star Wars than Sam Witwer, I would be fucking shocked.
Yeah.
That man is a walking Wikipedia. It is insane. He like lives and breathes and eats Star Wars. And the fact that he's Darth Maul is just absolutely wonderful. He apparently has been pretty, not instrumental, but very much in the story developing part of all of this. So, I know he's not the sole driving force, but, you know, you can kind of, like, I bet he's always in Dave's ear. Like, hey, man, I've got this. What do you think about this, like, as a Maul story? Like, he's so great. And the fact that he's getting to come back and do this again makes me really, really happy. I don't know that there's a more passionate, like, Star Wars fan and actor, you know, than Sam Witwer.
I mean, and his stuff started, like, he started in a Star Wars video game, like Star Wars Force Unleashed, mm-hmm. Where he played Starkiller. And it just kind of grew from there. I feel like this is the payoff for him playing Maul for such a long time. Like, and great. Like not just a little, like, not just, like, you know, just phoning it in. Like the things that I remember from Maul are things that he did, right? Like, more than anything, right? Like his arc in Rebels is probably some of the best stuff that happened for Maul. Like, the Clone Wars kind of used him as, like, it was very specific kind of things that they were telling and they were using him for. Whereas Rebels kind of made him a character. And
he's just always down. There's very few Star Wars projects that have happened in the last 10, 12 years, maybe. At least 10 years that he has not been a part of in some way, shape, or form. Like, if you look at anything, any Star Wars official thing, there's probably Sam Witwer's name in it as additional voices, like literally coming in. Speaking of Ahmed Best did a kids competition show where he played Jedi Kellen Beck, who got to show up in The Mandalorian, which was great. And it was, you know, a goofy, fun kids competition show, like the old, like, temple show on Nickelodeon or whatever it was. Sam Witwer was the dark side voice on that show. Like, there's this, you know, you can look it up on YouTube. I think they're all still available on YouTube.
It's a fun. It's a very fun, like, Nickelodeon-esque game show.
I mean, this dude was just like, I'll do the dark side stuff for this show that I'm probably nobody's really gonna watch. He's just always down, and getting to have his own show with this character, even if it winds up just being like, oh, we did these 10 or 20 episodes or whatever, and, like, that's what there is. That's the story we had to tell. It's just great. I'm so happy for him.
Absolutely. Like, it's a really great Again, like I said, like Clone Wars keeps on paying dividends to everybody. And if you haven't seen the show, it's on Disney Plus in its completed form. And you definitely need to see it, because like, if you're not really a Star Wars, like, I'm going to say it, if you haven't watched it, you're not really a Star Wars fan. I mean, hell, even my wife has watched it. You know, she may be more of a movie person, but she's at least seen it. So she knows, I mean, she's seen Rebels. She's seen all of the great animation. If a casual fan, like my wife, can actually watch all of it, then like, I can actually say with confidence, like, if you haven't watched it, you're not a real Star Wars fan, because that has some truly, like the bulk of what I consider truly great storytelling outside of the original trilogy is in that series.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, absolutely. Like, please go see it. Please watch it, because yeah, you're missing out on like a big chunk of what Star Wars is. So, yeah,
Force Unleashed was 2008. I just looked that up.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yep. And a very hard game. Like, I'll be honest.
I never played it. I have it. I never played it.
Oh god, I have it on my PlayStation Vita, and I played it. And dude, like, I could get, like, I got through the first three, like, the supposed first three levels, right? And I was like, oh fuck, now I remember why I hated it so much on PS2. Like, it was just, yeah, it was such a difficult game. Or maybe it was PS3. I can never remember. But yeah. So, great.
So let's talk about Daredevil real quick.
Yeah.
So we got the season finale of Daredevil this past week. Yep. And it was pretty fucking good.
Yeah, it was really good. I was gonna ask you something. I love everything. I love the whole Empire Strikes Back-esque ending, but the end of it, when he's in the when Matt as Daredevil goes through the bar, right? And is that a comic book panel that I'm just not aware of? Because it very much seemed like very comic book-esque, like, cover page, because we don't see who the cops are. We don't see anything other than, like, they're shot from backlight and he, like, walks in. And then it ends, like, kind of like that. And I'm like, okay, it seems very...
So I have a theory about that.
Okay,
please. It's not comic book specific. Okay. I really think that he was supposed to walk through. I think the plan was that very recognizable people for fans were supposed to be sitting in that bar.
It was supposed to be the Defenders.
I think so. I think that we were supposed to get at least some of them, maybe a couple of people from the movies that, like, maybe, you know, well, not Tom Holland, but I don't know. Like, I think that was the original plan, because that is shot very much like you're about to see something so cool. And it's like, okay, cool. I recognize three of these people. Like, one's the lady that runs the bar, whose name I don't even know, because, you know, what does that matter? Cherry, who we, you know, have been seeing.
Yeah, we see a close-up of him.
Yeah, and the his ex-partner, the cop, the one that's still in the force, the lady, her I recognize. And then, like, it was like, I feel like this was supposed to be such a big reveal and, like, get you primed for, like, oh, shit, I can't wait for season two. And it's kind of a letdown. That's the one thing in the whole episode that I was like, oh man, that moment, it's the slow motion, the music, the buildup. And it's like, oh, like you said, you needed an army. And yeah, I get that these people are going to fight on your side, but like, you were building up for something that you didn't have.
Exactly. Like, okay, so I'm not the only one, because that's what disappointed me, which was like, what is this about? Like, this doesn't seem like, that's where, like, okay, that's my only umbrage with this television. Like, there's no, like, I respect that there's no hope, but it was like, are you trying to give me hope here? With, like, this reveal, like, walking through, and it's like, okay, so a bunch of faceless cops and Cherry and, no, this doesn't help me at all. Like, this doesn't make me feel, like, I'm like, man, Kingpin's just gonna stay Kingpin, Mayor Kingpin forever now. It just didn't help, like, it. Like, the only, like, the coolest thing about the ending was the post-credit sequence with Frank. That was the only thing. And even then, it felt, like, so weirdly, like, performative. Like, yeah. It was like, there's no way this fucking cop, this Tony cop, would ever get close to the chained animal pit bull that is Frank. There's no way. What the fuck are you talking about? Like, but anywho, like, but I'm sorry to kind of derail it with the end at the beginning, but I mean, I was so just kind of like awed at the fact that they let Kingpin win and there's like no hope whatsoever. Like, at least in my estimation, it didn't feel like there was any hope whatsoever. And that last scene really stuck out to me because it was like, this is supposed to give me hope. These are the people, because it doesn't feel like it. And you're saying about the plan, about the defenders being there, or like certain like heroes being like silhouettes, man, that would have been badass. Like, really badass. Like, if I saw, like, you know, if you saw Luke Cage, you saw, like, you know,
Jessica Jones, even Danny Rand. Claire, I can't remember, the night nurse. It's like anything. It, like, I feel like that build up was like, in the immediate letdown was the one like bogus thing about the episode. The rest of it was great though. The combat stuff, the action scenes, Punisher versus the cops was absolutely brutal. That's kind of a thing taken right out of I think Garth Ennis's run on the Punisher, where he goes after them and it's just like, you know, you're wearing my symbol and, you know, you don't understand who I am and you are supposed to be better than this. And so, you know, he views them as the criminals that they are, you know. Despite the, like, fans. Oh, we look up to you, we idolize you. He's like, you shouldn't be idolizing me. And then he, you know, just tries to kill all of them, but only gets a few. It's you can see the difference in this. Like, look at episode like 2 and look at this, and you can see a big, big difference.
Absolutely.
This is the show that. You know, they wanted to retool it into, so season 2 will definitely be, you know, a much better show. I didn't hate season 1. In fact, I wanted a more lighthearted show. I get that that's not what a lot of people want, but I'm also happy to watch, you know, this version of Daredevil, as long as they're going to get it right. And it really feels like they did for this final episode. And the Punisher stuff, like, really does kind of make the show.
It really does. And, like, it makes me super excited for this television special that we're supposed to be getting by the end of the year.
Which I assume that's what the post-credit thing was supposed to be setting up, so that they could do the special and it not be like, well, last time we saw him, he was in a cage in Kingpin's dungeon, you know? Yeah. So where do we go from there? And that's fine. But if you don't know that that's what they're setting up, it feels really weird that the post-credit scene for this was the Punisher.
Yeah, But at the same time, like, I feel like this one is for the fans. Like, it's like trying to give them an ending to this version of Daredevil before they kind of like do another reboot of the character, because so many people were like, we love this character and we love the Netflix shows. And it's like, it's almost like he's just going, like, Kevin, this is very much Kevin, right? Going, hey, I hear you. Let's do this. And we will do this. And we're going to give you 18 episodes, which is basically 2.5 seasons of, or almost 2 seasons of Daredevil, but we're going to end it the way that we want to end it, but still doing it the way that you want it. Sorry. You know, unchaining Punisher from Daredevil really doesn't excite me, because I really would like to see him in other properties, but also kind of understand that you don't want to detooth this particular Frank, because this is very much so like the Punisher you want. Like, I think we've talked about it before, where I was like, I don't know, man, just let Punisher die for a while, because, like, you know, just so much of what that character in the real world means. But man, the way that they've brought it, and the way that Brenthal has very much leaned into exactly what you want him to lean into, and go like, man, you guys are a bunch of wimps, and, you know, you like, you fake fanboys, like, you have no idea about my life. Like, it's almost like the commentary of, like, you really don't understand what the Punisher means. You just, like, you know, you're using it as like a bully badge.
Yeah.
And him kind of like taking his power back.
And good, you know, and it's weird because Bernthal kind of did that with he's taken such ownership of the character that he initially declined, like, to return because of what they were doing with the character. And he was like, I don't think that this is, it's definitely not for me. You know, I can't tell you not to use the Punisher, but it won't be me. So, I mean, standing up for the character and what he represents, not what he's been turned into, like, it means a lot, you know, to see him take that kind of ownership. Did you see he was interviewed this past week, I guess, you know, because he had such a big part in the finale, and I don't know what the question was, but he started talking about the MCU stuff, and he and Tom Holland were doing a movie together.
Yes. Post
Punisher and Spider-Man. And per John Bernthal, he filmed Tom Holland's audition tape for Spider-Man.
For Spider-Man. And
Holland, like, filmed his audition tape for the Punisher.
Yeah. Have you seen that movie? It's a wild ass movie. It's like set in medieval times. It's one of those, like, okay, do you remember back in the mid 2010s, the mid teens, when like British, like the British direct to video market was all about age movies with like the Knights Templar. It's a movie like that. That's the kind of movie, like, he plays like a Knights Templar that's turned into a monk, Brenthal, and like Tom Holland plays like a page or a squire. It's very of that era. It's very like, but it's also very kind of like, it's not great, but it's not bad. But like, you watch it and you go, oh, there's pun. Like, I watched it and I was like, they promoted it like these two were like the stars of the movie and they're just co-stars. And you watch it and you go, oh, that's really weird seeing Punisher and Spider-Man interact with British accents and, like, you know, ho ho, ho dee ho, tally ho, dilly dilly. But I did see that was wild to me to think that they were in their off time, like, shooting like their like, you know, their auditions, their respective auditions. Frank and Pete were, which, like, you know, it's so funny to think about that, like, in the cosmic universe of it all, like, you know, Frank was like sent to kill Pete, like in the early era of Marvel, right? And here these two guys are like you know, helping each other out get their roles respectively. It's kind of wild, but yeah, I loved that.
Yeah, I thought that was just such a cool little like fact to find out.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I'm excited for season two of Daredevil. The fact that they're filming right now is, you know, that means probably about same time next year. Like we're gonna get season two. It won't be this long ass wait for something, which is nice. Mm-hmm. I mean, a year is still a year for 9 episodes, but it's still not 2 years to get 9 episodes. So,
exactly.
All right. So if we don't have anything else, we got the Sinners to talk about. And I think there's a lot to talk about here.
Oh yeah. So high level thoughts, like what was your, like, I mean, we've been talking about this for a year, literally a year. We've been talking about this, or 2 years, since the project was announced, it was filmed, and now it's released into the world. I'd like to know what your thoughts are before mine. Like last time we did it the opposite.
Yeah.
So, I'm gonna
start with the good stuff. I think the movie looks phenomenal, but that shouldn't be a surprise. Coogler's a excellent visual director. I think every person in this movie is giving, if not the best performance of their career, in the upper echelon performances of their career. Michael B. Jordan gives two very different performances. Both are just fucking excellent. But down to the like minutia cast, I think every single person is giving the best performances of their career. The music is unbelievably good. I was not shocked that the music was good. I knew Goranson was involved. What really kind of not shook me, but like it actually made me happy when you get to the producing credits on the movie, his name is in the credits for producing along with Coogler and Michael B. Jordan, and I think his wife as well.
Yeah, Goranson's wife is, because she, like, if you've ever watched, like, if you watched the Wakanda, the like it's the Wakanda Forever, the Black Panther 2 Wakanda Forever making of, but not
I need to watch that.
But the music one, you will find out that Goranson's wife, like him, went to USC and got her like doctoral thesis on music, not just any music, but world history, which is very like is a huge component of this film. Like, I knew that Coogler was a dude that loved music, but I didn't realize how much of a student of music he was until this film. Which is an odd thing to say, but we will get into the minutia of it. We will definitely get into the minutia of it. And but yeah, like what everything that you said. But yeah, like the whole thing of Goranson and his wife and like everything being produced by him. Like, straight up, wow.
It blew my mind to see him in the, like, producing credits of the movie. It shows you how central, like, the music themes are. And I think the movie approaches a lot of ideas with, like, a lot of things with really interesting ideas about them, like, post-war South. Like, the idea of that there was a huge difference between the South and the North versus for African Americans. The ideas of like what a Black person could be in post-war South, the ideas of religion used to further subjugate people, which that's not an original idea, but this there's a moment in the movie where Remick, Jack O'Connell's character, is talking about how Christianity was used to subjugate his people.
Yep.
And like that was also done with African Americans, like brought over as slaves. This was not their religion, it was forced on them, but then like it becomes this different thing for them. And it's like this complicated relationship you have to it, to the spirituality, and how they've kind of merged things, like the Christian stuff with the more most people at the time would have seen it as like witchcrafty kind of stuff.
Yes, but the African like what I call African mysticism of their culture, the snake, like the snake charming, the snake blood ritual side of it, which like the voodoo aspect of it, but it's all based off of African mysticism and African religious beliefs that were taken from Africa and put, like, you know, when they were forced into slavery.
And I think it also has some really interesting things to say about love and grief and just all of this stuff. I think it is, 70% of a really great movie. And we can get into the bad after you talk about it some more.
Okay. So we disagree. Like, I feel like this is a mini masterpiece. Like, and so let me define this for everybody so that they don't like try to come at me. Like, a masterpiece isn't perfect. Like, there's no perfect film. You can get close. And I feel like this is more of like a 90% for me. Because like, and a mini masterpiece is like a lowercase masterpiece, because I feel like everything that was intended to happen happened. And I think that it's messy for a reason. I kind of fucking love this film and everything that it says and everything that it does and how surprising it is and the way that it uses music to tell its story. And
I want to add one more thing to my positive on the music front, not to interrupt you. Sorry. Idea of music being this connection to our past and our future, I also think it's really fucking interesting. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, absolutely. Because that's where I was going with it, which is that I feel like it's just the first time I've seen it, and I will watch it multiple times because it was very interesting to me that, so like, instead of using the normal tropes of a horror movie and the, like, you know, the justifications for certain things in a horror movie, like Coogler took the music aspect and the power of music and the mysticism, like African American mysticism, and like melded it with the reasonings. And like when we heard about this film and the plot started coming out, it became like very basic. Like, it was like, oh well, vampires get turned into like the clan. It's like a bunch of clan members that are vampires, and it's them versus the the people of color. But it is not that. Like, this movie is not about that. This movie is about like Remick is, so like Remick is, like, they say he's Irish, but I don't think he's Irish. I think he's like, and it's very different, he's Gaelic. Like, he comes from...
Oh, absolutely. I think it's an easier thing to just say he's Irish, but this is a dude that's existed for a very long time. And so, like, it's weird to look at it as, like, this is kind of the white person's version of, like, what... It's not slavery, but...
Yeah. Subjugation.
Yeah. Like, and because you have the Christians come into that area. I mean, it's where, like, we're on Easter Sunday. We associate a lot of Easter stuff has nothing to do with the actual Christian religion or church. A lot of what we associate with Easter comes from, like, the paganism and stuff from that culture, like, from their past. You know, it's really, really interesting to like watch those ideas be brought a little more to the forefront.
Absolutely. And how, like, it's the coins, that are the mm-hmm. Roman coins. That's the thing that, like, instantly unlocked that Rimmick was, he's not a bad guy, but he's also not a good guy. He's not, like, they don't, like, the thing that I find so fascinating about this movie that elevated it beyond, like, even, like, the best of the horror movies that I've seen recently is that it gets into this moral complicated nature of, like, who are really the, like, it goes back to the universal thing of, like, the universal horror movies of, like, who's really the horrible, who is really the villain? And at the end, we find out who the villain is, right? Like, we find out who the true villainy is, because Rimmick is not, like, Rimmick has intentions to do things that he feels like it's bad, but from an outsider's perspective, from his perspective, he's trying to do exactly what he's trying to make his people survive, right? And he doesn't look at these people, like, he doesn't look at the people that are in the juke joint as he looks at them as family, connected to them, like he's connected to them because of what happened to his people, because the Romans took his people from him and forced religion on him, right? Like, you know, the Constantinople of it,
yeah,
all, or the Constantine of it.
But there's also this element of, like, it is also this power over them.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
And how complicated that is.
Exactly. And how he keeps on, like, how, like, the temptation, and, like, that's, like, the most, like, this is where it kind of elevates it, because it, like, became this whole thing with, like, where I was, like, talking to my wife about it, and how, like, interesting it was that Rimmick is a villain, but he's really not a villain. Like, yes, he's turning people into vampires, and, like, he's trying to get them, but he gives them the truth because they're all interconnected. He literally tells him, I killed these piece of shit clan people because his uncle, the guy you bought this juke joint from, was going to come in the morning and shoot you all. And at first they don't believe it, because they would rather believe a human, like, they would rather believe that he is not telling the truth, that he is lying to them, that the honest truth of it all, like, you know. And it's wild to think that, like, there's this moment that you will never, like, okay, so, like, there's two moments that you will never see in other films, or it will be copied constantly, that is so unique, and, like, nothing in, like, this is the first Ryan Coogler movie, like, I to me, this is the first thing that is him.
I would argue that Fruitvale Station is
him,
but
yes.
It is, Fruitvale Station is also based on something that really happened. Exactly. So this, in the sense that, like, this is not him adapting something. Yeah, 100%. Like, I'm with you there. It is through and through, like, Coogler, and, you know, by association, his family, like, he's been working with a large number of the same people since Fruitvale Station. Like,
exactly. Like, all of them are, like, including Jordan. Like, and, like, so here's the thing is, like, there's two sections of this film that I feel like this is Coogler's heart out there and what music means. It's the spirits of past and future and present musical number, which is fucking amazing. Like, that's flat out, like, something I've never seen before, never probably will, unless it's Ryan Coogler. Like, and I don't even think Ryan Coogler, like, it's like Coogler going, I am not the next Spielberg. I am not the next P.T. Anderson. I am fucking Ryan Coogler, and people are going to be fucking coming out, and people will look at them and go, that is the next Ryan Coogler. It's not, it's like, it's putting his authority on, in a period on, like filmmaking in his own way. And the Rimmick dancing scene. Because they're both very similar, but very different, right? And to, like, the power in which you're seeing all of those people, like, and they've been churned, and the song that they're singing, and if you really listen to it and what it's talking about, it is talking about subjugation. It's talking about his people being subjugated in a very Irish limerick sort of, like,
yeah.
But to see both black and white people talking because they are, like, essentially the same thing that has happened to them.
Yeah.
It's very powerful.
But it's also something that he's actively doing.
Yes. And
that's what makes it, like I said, that there's so many interesting ideas at play here. There's so much to explore here. And I think that's part of the problem with the movie, is that there is a lot here that they can't get into more, because it needs to be also a kind of horror movie vampire story. And part of that's kind of where it just falls flat for me.
Okay.
When it becomes
that whole standard genre where when Grace basically lets them in and it becomes this whole, it becomes a very much so like a genre.
I was in this movie. Mm-hmm. Up until, like, it became, like, it almost, I when Steph and I left the movie, I compared it to From Dusk Till Dawn, even though I think this is a much better film than that. No slight to Robert Rodriguez, but that movie, like, I'm in that movie until it actually becomes the movie it advertised itself as. Which is the last, 20, 30 minutes. It's been a while since I watched it, but it's only, the last 30 minutes that From Dusk Till Dawn is a vampire movie. Maybe a little bit longer than that. But it's mostly, about these relationships, these two brothers, and, their relationship to these people that they've kidnapped, and the complications with all that. I could have watched a whole fucking movie about Michael B. Jordan as these two brothers and all of the trauma that they faced and them working that out. It was so good and so he's just excellent. But
yeah,
it just kind of loses me with the more traditional vampire stuff. Because they'd done such a good job of grounding all of that it felt just really jarring for it to all of a sudden try to be a horror movie. The other thing is, I know that they've been working together literally since Fig, that short film that kind of launched him into Fruitvale Station, but his editor, I can't think of the guy's name. I have to look it up. But Michael P. Shaver. I don't think... I think he needs to... He needs some oversight. I think this movie is very poorly edited. I just... The cutaways... The way scenes are laced into each other, I don't think works, especially at the end. It's great in the beginning because you're getting pieces of the story, from either brother, when they go their separate ways, which also I think the script could use a little bit of editing. You didn't need to make it feel so forced that, like, oh, we have to split these two up so that we're not spending a shit ton of money filming him twice so we can piece this together. Like, I don't think you could have just said, you're going to go do this, I'm going to go do that. You didn't need, like, it's only brief, but this story of, like, we're running out of time, so you have to go do this, and I have to, I don't know, it feels a little forced in the dialogue. Like, I don't think we needed that, but that's minor compared to, like, the editing at the end. I mean, the fight between the two brothers at the end, laced with, like, everything else that's going on, every time you cut away, it pissed me off.
Okay.
Because I was like, just stick with a story for more than a minute. Stop cutting away. Like, because it's, especially with the brothers, I think it does a disservice to the emotional weight of what's going on there, because you're cutting away from it. And I also think that this goes with the editing. This movie, if you lose 30 minutes out of this movie, I think it's damn, maybe not perfect, but it's a lot fucking better. I think there's easily 30 minutes you could lose. I don't think you need the scene of, I understand why it's there because of the Klan stuff at the end, but I don't think you need the scene where he goes and gets those two people and turns them.
Okay, so, like, this is where you and I will disagree, because I feel like that absolutely needs to happen, because of Remick's, like, I feel like this is a story of, like it's not just the story about Smoke and Stack. I think it's a story, it's a pastiche of many characters, especially when, you know, the post-credit sequence, like what happens in the post-credit sequence.
I also don't think that that's needed.
I
think you could lose that too.
Okay. So, like, this is where we just disagree, because, like, I feel like this is more of a story of multiple people, and, like, you know, I think it, and it's mostly about Preacher, like, about Sammy or Preacher Boy.
Wait, this is his first movie.
Miles Canton?
Yeah, first movie. Fucking home run performance. Home run performance. Like, it is, like, the equivalent of, I don't know if Fruitvale was Michael B. Jordan's first movie, but it's like, that was the first thing I saw him in, where I was just like, I see Fruitvale Station, I'm like, this guy's fucking got it, man.
Yep.
I hate to do this, because we're not going to recast Chadwick Boseman. We're not going to recast Black Panther. We are where we are. If they wait, if they pause on Wakanda Forever and they do decide to recast this guy, this is the guy. Like, yeah. I'm watching this, I was like, ah, oh. Like, in a world where we lose Chadwick and they wait on a new Black Panther movie, this could have been the fucking guy. Because he is great. He has that thing that Chadwick Boseman kind of had. I don't think he's to that level, but I think he's really, really, like, he's close to that.
He could get, that's the thing, is that he is so kind of, like, he's, like, it's very much so, like, it's very much so, like what Fruitvale Station showed Michael B. Jordan. Like, it was, like, the promise of, right? Like, the best part about Jordan is, like, I remember him from Hardball. Like, he was, like, the little kid in Hardball. Like, one of the little kids in Hardball, the Keanu Reeves alcoholic.
I never saw that movie.
Okay. It's really good. It's like Coach Carter. Like, if you've ever watched Coach Carter, it's, like, one of those kinds of, like, you know, like, in the early 2000s, we were making, like, you know, teachers in like, I hate using the word ghetto.
Hardball was actually his first movie. So
So like, and then like, also like, you know, you got Chronicle, like he was good in Chronicle, something that I think that
Was Chronicle before Fruitvale Station?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Then I did see Chronicle first. So maybe that would have been where I was like, oh shit, this guy. So yeah, I was wrong. Chronicle would be first.
But yeah, no, like, he is so good in this. And I feel he's one of many people that this is like this is their story. And mostly this is like he's the soul of the story, right? Like you, but also like you kind of like it's kind of perfect that they cast Buddy Guy at the end as Miles, because I mean, yeah. It's like there's that shorthand connection to, you know, a man who like a big part of modern blues is Buddy Guy. And it's like, I don't know, this is where like, I'm like, I'm okay with it being 2.5 hours because I'm spending time with all of these characters and I didn't find the editing as jarring as you did, because like, I was looking at it like that final scene where they're cutting between the things. It's like a play on the Star Wars triumphant editing, right? Like where you go between, it's a little bit faster. I will give
that's
you that.
That's the like, thing. It's choppy. It's so choppy. You don't have time to take, like, Return of the Jedi. You are cutting between, like, the throne, Emperor's throne room fight stuff with Vader and Palpatine and Luke, and what's going on Endor, but you're getting to sit in those moments. It's not here's 30, 45 seconds and then back to this for 45 seconds. And like, it just, I think it does a disservice to the weight of what is going on specifically with the two brothers.
Okay. I could here's the thing. I'm not opposed to it, because if you were seeing like if you watch this movie and you latch on to Smoke and Stack, then it becomes this thing of like,
I definitely did. Maybe because of my own, like I had a twin brother and he passed away, and like watching that play out is really emotionally, I don't want to say satisfying, but you know, it's a catharsis, I guess.
Yes.
So it was pissing, like literally pissing me off when I was like, come on, man. Like, you are not, like, this is the relationship, you know, it was frustrating. So.
And I could see like that, like, okay. So from that aspect, if you were latched on to Smoke and Stack and you do like, and everything else is secondary in this story, then yes, that absolutely rings true for me. Like, I could see how, like, and again, this is why I said not masterpiece with a capital M, but a mini masterpiece, because this is a film that I feel like will not work for some people. And it will be various reasons why it doesn't work. But for those who it connects, like you're watching the wavelength and the wavelength is in tune with you, then it's like that thing of like, oh yeah, this is like the movie. But again, it's all in like point of view. Like, I can totally, now I see what you're talking about, because it's the whole thing of the relation, like that relationship is so strong, and it's such a strongly, like, Michael B. Jordan is so good as the two brothers and creating that.
Fucking cool, unbelievable, man. Like, he's always good. We just through talking about that. But I'm not joking when I said, I think every single person in this movie is giving, if not the best performance of their career, definitely up there, down to the minutiae characters. The I can't remember their names, but the grocery,
Bao Chao and Grace, yes, who are played by Lee Jun Lee and Yao.
Yeah,
they're
fucking phenomenal. Like, her heartache, like at seeing him turned, like, it is. fucking great. Like it's such a good performance. The guy that plays Cornbread, who I've always enjoyed, but like he was a big part of The Rock's football show on HBO.
Yes. Ballers.
Ballers, yeah. And he was fucking fantastic in Ballers. He's great here. Like he has to play this like he kind of did in Ballers too, but he has to play this like comic foil, like goofy. Mm-hmm. And he does it really, really well. And he has to like turn on a dime from like, oh, goofy Cornbread to like, oh, no, I'm terrifying. I think he does that great. Delroy Lindau, it's hard to say this is top tier performance for him because the man has been doing it so long that it's like, yeah. Oh, wait, what about this? What about this? What about this? But he's so fucking good here. I don't really understand his sacrifice there at the end. Like, dude, they went upstairs. Like, what do you think they're getting away from? Like, they're not going to get away. Like, you're sacrificing yourself for nothing. But up until that point, that's just, I think, a bad move in the script. But he is fucking top notch, man. Like, from the moment he enters, I was just like, damn, he is just taking this away from anybody who's in a scene with him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then like we've not talked about the two female leads, like the major Hailee Steinfeld and Womuni Mosaku, who we know in she plays B-15 from Loki.
Yeah.
And also Deadpool and Wolverine, who both respectively are fucking like just amazing. Given they're not the atypical female leads, but they are like, you know, they kind of lean into certain things, but not really. They're just phenomenal. Like Hailee Steinfeld, like, I mean, this is not an MCU performance. That's for damn sure.
Yeah.
And the weird part is like Michael B. Jordan has to play off of both of them. Like, yeah. In very different ways, but also like chemistry wise, it's a wild thing. It goes back to kind of like how good Michael B. Jordan is, that his characters like have chemistry with both of these women because they're both the love interests for the respective brothers, right?
Yeah.
But they're all both very different.
Very, and, very different, yeah.
And how like that's approached is like it's not only like it not only speaks to the performances, but also like the thing also is that Kugler wrote this. Like, I, you know, Kugler,
yeah.
Like, fuck, wow.
I do wonder if there is a little bit of, and this is not me being cynical about it. I actually think it's kind of amusing if the movie weren't so like pretty self-serious about dealing with like race and culture, but like,
yeah.
The white woman is the which they say in the movie she's not
she's not fully white,
yeah,
but she's white past,
yeah, but it is kind of like I wonder if it's a commentary like on that specific kind of trope or thought, but that's just me like wondering about where the ideas came from for certain things. I think it all plays really, really well. I think she's great. But I think she is outshined by Womuni Mosaku, like you were saying. And so I also want to, this is going to sound weird, much like the white woman thing, but just the fact that, so not only do you have this character dealing with like with the grief and loss and her complicated relationship with her ex husband, partner, like whatever they are. She is not you have a few other, there's one other like prominent female character who shows up to the Duke. I can't remember the character's name, but it's the one that Preacher Boy kind of has a fling with.
Yeah, the one that ends up singing.
Yeah. Who is very much like the thin, sexy, like typical, and so is Hailee Steinfeld. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's that model beauty, but then you also give her, like, you don't frame her in a, I don't know how to, I mean, I'm a big dude, so you're formally a big dude.
What's doing?
To frame somebody, like to shoot them in a way that doesn't make them like just seem like, oh, this is a big person and they can't be sexy. And I mean, she's extremely sexy in the movie.
Yes. And, oh, absolutely. Like, I know. Okay. So now I know what you're trying to say. Like, yeah, it's one of those things where you kind of go, like, they don't play the cliche. Like, everybody, like, so, like, it's easy to shoot Hailee Steinfeld and
right
the other girl, like, as
when they're dancing and like the outfits they're with, like, it don't take a lot of work to make them sexy, man.
No,
and I don't think it takes a lot of work to make her sexy either. I think she's a very attractive woman.
Oh yeah,
but it's the typical prototypical Hollywood, like, if you are not this, you know, like, idea of beauty, you don't really get shot in a way that lets you be beautiful. You know, you kind of, and when they do shoot you trying to, quote, be sexy, it, they play it for laughs, you know? And
yeah. And they don't hear.
Yeah. Like, which, if they did, it would be completely out of place in this movie. But, like, yeah, they just let her be, you know, not just all the other things, but also a, you know, a sexy person, a sexual creature. The, you know, like, you have their very brief love scene, which could also be shot, like, is kind of like off-putting or just a little goofy, or, but, like, it's not. It's on top of, like, all of the grief stuff, like, it's pretty steamy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like you said, like, it's not played for laughs. It's not played for anything other than, like, this is the story that they're telling. And I think it a lot speaks to the way that Coogler approaches things and how he looks at the world, because that's all that matters, right? Like, it's all in how you tell the story and what you look at the world like. And if you don't look at the world in a full spectrum of color and sizes and shapes, then it's shown through. Like, there's an easiness in which it's telling its story that the grocers are Vietnamese. Like, it doesn't feel like, when you come in, like, there, it's like, it's all shot beautifully, like, where it's like these tracking shots, right?
And, oh, it's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, and then they just go in, and he starts talking to Bo Chan, right? Like, he just starts, or Bo Chow, and he just starts talking and dealing with him, right? Not, and it's not.
I do like that they get the Han, Lando, like,
yeah,
moment of reunion. Like, I really liked that. I don't know why that trope works for me, but I guess because I love Star Wars so much. But I do like the, like, oh, we're going to act like, what are you doing here? Like, I never wanted to see your face again. And then they hug, and I'm like, I don't know. This always just works for me.
Yeah,
He was the only fucking one who, when he got turned, I was just like, fuck.
Yeah. He's really great. And it just speaks to, like, how good the kind of, like, weird, like, it's not weird, like, it's just, we don't see it. We don't see, like, the way that, like, so this is, like, this, like, this movie affirms something to me, is that, like, the way that, the way that you view the world is the way that you direct the movie. And it can come off performative, and it can come off genuine and integrated and real. And Coogler is a guy that it feels like it's something that I always knew. Like, so like, I'm going to make a comparison. Like, this movie feels so organic in everything that it does in a way that, like, so Black Panther feels authentic when anybody says Wakanda Forever, and where the Russos use that, it feels so false and so phony and so fucking just like you should not be allowed to use Black Panther or any of its characters, Russo brothers, in your move, in your Avengers movies. Like, does that make sense? Like, it's like this weird thing of where,
you don't know how to shoot it. You don't know how to, like, it's,
you don't know how, it's not your characters. And it's not your, it doesn't, like, the feeling that you have and the way that you're telling the story just doesn't feel authentic. Whereas, like, Coogler, everything that he's doing in this movie feels authentic. So much so that you have a problem with the way that he's telling his story because he's so authentic with his storytelling and his viewpoint, right? Like, he understands twins. Like, if it came out that Ryan Coogler had a twin, I'd be like, that makes sense.
Yeah, that tracks. So, yeah.
Exactly. And it's like,
I agree. What? I agree. I was just saying, I agree.
Mm-hmm. But it's all in the way that I like feel like I was telling my wife, I'm like, this is a movie in 20 years. I'm not going to matter. It's not going to matter to me some of the inconsistencies because they're going to be have rubbed off. It's like the first time you saw The Thing, right? I don't remember the first time I saw The Thing.
He also riffs on that.
He does with the garlic scene, which is like, that's another thing where it's like, we've never really had somebody play on some of these vampire tropes the same way, but also absolutely, he takes concepts and then he turns them and plays them with something else. And he kind of combines them, right? Like you talked about From Dusk Till Dawn. I think the reason why we're referencing that is because Michael B. Jordan gets to do the George Clooney vest thing. But mm-hmm. it's not done in the same way, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's done in a very different way. It's like, there's a lot of that. But also, like I'm going to say, like, in 10 years, when all the edges are rubbed off of this, I'm not gonna remember certain things, certain inconsistencies. I'm just going to see the movie. Like I said, like Carpenter's The Thing, right? Like, I see that as a movie that I'm like, that's like one of the most perfect movies that I've ever seen in my life. But there are inconsistencies there. I know that they are, but watching it over time, it's rubbed, the edges have rubbed off because I've been able to fill the gaps of the story properly for myself.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that that's like, it's too early to tell with Sinners, right? But my feeling is that everything there is there for me to make a meal out of this in 10 years. Like, you know, and not just me, but like other people, I feel like we're going to have conversation. We're going to keep on having conversations about this movie because Ryan Coogler's just that fucking good, right? Like, he's just that good. And even the people that find, like you said, like there's 70%, this is a 70% movie for you, right? That 70% will probably always still be there, but you'll be able to, like, if you watch it a couple of more times, I feel like you'll be able to fill up the cup. Now there's going to be certain things that will just not work. And now that I see that for you, like the brother storyline, it will never be as satisfying as what you want it to be because you want it to be about the brothers. And to me, that makes sense. And there's like, and this is where we have this conversation, like all great movies, like we can have this conversation of like, well, that doesn't work. But at the end of the day, it's still like, wow, this is a fucking fascinating movie, right? Like,
oh, I agree with that. Yeah, 100% agree with that. So,
you know, and then like the one thing I will say is the trailer should have not ruined the Tommy Gunn scene. Because
you're just waiting for it and you kind of know, like, oh, okay, I know where this is going. There's a few things in the trailer. I think one of them turning, I think, is ruined in the trailer.
Oh, yeah. They should have never shown.
Yeah. The marketing for this movie, I get they wanted to try to really, really push into the vampire thing. but the marketing for this movie, I think, did a disservice to some of the better moments because they're in the fucking trailer, and yeah, that sucks. But yeah, you know, I mean, over time, maybe like I'll look back on it if I do rewatch it. Maybe I'll feel a little bit differently, especially rewatching it at home. It might be, you know, might creep up to like 75-80% of a really good to great movie. It boils down to some different editing choices, a couple of like dialogue script cuts, and I won't even say 30 minutes, 20 minutes.
Like, just make it a 2-hour movie instead of a 2.5-hour movie. Yeah. Okay. Get it.
20 minutes, like that, especially the end. I think that very, very end is completely unnecessary, and there's some interstitial stuff, like specifically, like I think just the vampire showing up is a more interesting idea than like him, like the Native Americans never come back up, man. Like that story never comes back up, so
it
feels weird that it's even there. So you lose 20, 22 minutes, make a little bit different choices in the editing, like let some scenes breathe towards the end. I think I'm with you in that this is like a low level masterpiece. And the first, it is the first out and out Coogler movie, but like it is upper echelon Coogler. Coogler. Right now, I think that it's slightly above Wakanda Forever in his very short, you know, career so far.
Yeah.
So.
No, okay. That you know what? And that absolutely makes sense. Like, and that's what I feel like this is his most interesting movie and his most Coogler movie.
I agree with you there. I do think it's his most interesting movie because he's not really beholden to anything. Okay. Like, he's exploring ideas, maybe not fully, but exploring ideas that interest him. And I think like that it's great. It just, it could have been brilliant, and I think it's just good.
Okay. Like that's so. and like I'm not gonna disagree with you because like this movie is a movie like that I feel is like open and wide enough to where it's, that's like, you know, to me, that's like where it's making its flag is that it's not a perfect movie. But it's a movie that's like has enough space and gaps to where people can love it or like it, but also there's a conversation to be had within it, right?
Yeah.
And like you can even fall in the middle and it be one of those things that you go, yeah, you know what, it's not for me, but it's also kind of like, you know, I'm very much so like, you know, like I like a lot of it, and that's not a bad thing. Like, right? Like, that's really not a bad thing. Like, I'm like, you know, that is something that you could like, you know, that's where, like, to me, that's where interesting movies lie, is not in the fact that, oh yeah, it's a brilliant movie. No, like sometimes brilliant movies are like the least interesting. And this is like one of the most interesting films that he's done.
Yeah.
Because he's not, like you said, he's not tied to IP. Like that's the thing to me is that like his,
even though this could easily become IP, like much From Dusk Till Dawn, like you could dive into this specific vampire lore, like dig into the past, get into the future. Like there's stuff you could explore here.
But also music, right?
Yeah.
Like, because the mid credit sequence is all about like a certain specific era, right?
Yeah.
Like when they show up, when the two characters show up, they're very much like, dude, they look like they can't, like, and I almost wonder if it's like Kugler's
It's a little jarring.
But it's also kind of funny because it almost feels like a play on House Party, right?
Yeah,
like
absolutely. Like look like they stepped out of the early 90s, but it's so jarring to. But anyway, yeah, it's. I hope more people do go see it. I do hope it makes money. Because it is an original film, and we need much like Death of a Unicorn. Like, it's like nobody's going to see this stuff, but this is the stuff we need to support, even if it's like it's okay. I was happy I went and saw it, like, but I just wish it was better. So anyway, I don't know what we're going to talk about next week, because I'll talk to you off air, but I got some stuff going on next weekend. We'll figure it out. Nothing's really coming out next week. I know I'm going to see Revenge of the Sith at some point, so I don't know. We'll figure it out. But until then, go check out everything else we're doing over at xwingfiles.com, or you can read our written work over at Adam's website.
Yes, themovieowl.com, where right now there's a bunch of 4K reviews that I got going on. So you can go ahead and check that stuff out. There'll be some pretty big box sets that are being released that I'm actually covering. So check out that stuff. Like Ryan's, or why did I say Ryan? Christ, dude. I'm so sorry about that.
It's like so I'm talking much. To my mom.
Dude, like, we've been talking about, like, it's weird because, like, we talk about your brother a lot, but like the last couple of episodes.
Yeah, it has been a lot of, and I don't know, like, where, I mean, I know, like, what's causing me to think about it, but it's weird that it's in the air, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Is it just me, or does it feel like, honestly, like, a lot of stuff, like, it's made me miss Ryan, I'll be honest with you, dude, like seeing his posts and stuff, but it feels like there's a lot of stuff that's being released.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. There has not been like a week that has gone by in this year, maybe. But the last few months, there's barely a day that goes by that I don't watch something that I'm like, God, I wish I could call him and talk about this, man. It's been in the air, so to speak. So.
It really has. Like, I didn't even mention it to you. Like, it's just like watching stuff. I feel the same fucking way. It's like, man, this is like a Ryan thing.
Oh, and yeah. I'm pretty sure Stephanie is sick of, like, anytime we're out somewhere, I'm just like, oh, hey, like, I'm just randomly at, like, Walmart or something. We'll come across something. I'll be like, oh, Ryan loved XYZ. And, like, I'm sure she's to a point now where it's like, everywhere we go, it's like something like, oh, your brother would have liked this. Oh, Ryan liked this. But it does seem to be, like, permeating, like, building up to something. I mean, this year will be 5 years since he passed. So, I don't know. Yeah, it's really, really strange. So, there it is. So, and I'm going to see Revenge of the Sith next week. So.
One of his favorite.
He did love that movie. I think it was in his top three, and it's not for me, but maybe we'll talk about that next week. So, go check out all that stuff, and we'll see you guys soon.
Number 2 comics, number 3 Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, number 4 Mario, number 5 Weird Al, number 6 Batman, number 7 Kal-El, number 8 Simpsons, number 9 TV, number 10 every single band that has stole all their MP3s, but they're really all sold out. See it all together if you're with me now.